It's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's a magic marker. A felt pen.
It's a mistake.
It's a trap.
It's a fucking comedy.
It's quiet. Maybe too quiet.
It's all happening.
It's a good day to die.
It's a good day to talk about movies.
Welcome back. It is a good day to talk about Severance Season 1. I am your host, Duncan. Joining me, as always, is Gardner.
Welcome back, folks. The work is mysterious and important.
Yes, it is. And joining us today is our friend, Nyatva. Nyatva, thanks for being here.
Absolutely, fellas. Love this show. I'm excited to talk about it a little bit more.
Hell yeah. So today we are recapping the first season of Severance, the new show on Apple TV+. This discussion will contain spoilers for the entire season of Severance. So if you don't want it spoiled, stop listening now and get back to us later. For everyone else, that was your spoiler warning for Severance Season 1. A quick reminder, on this podcast, we talk about movies and TV shows we love and interview independent filmmakers. We have full episodes that release every Friday, usually with a guest, where we often conduct our interviews of filmmakers. Last Friday, we released an episode on Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, where we had friend of the pod, Derek, on as a guest. This week, we have an interview releasing on Friday in 2 days. That episode will be an interview with Australian filmmaker Alex Lorien, whose shorts are available to watch on YouTube. A link to watch those will be in the podcast description for this episode, so check those out if you haven't seen them already. Alex also has a feature film releasing right about now, which has pre-orders for the Blu-ray on sale now. He was a great guest, so get excited for that. Last week, on Wednesday, we discussed The Dark Knight Rises as we wrapped up our bonus miniseries on the Christopher Nolan Batman trilogy. We've released bonus episodes on all three films in the Dark Knight trilogy, so go check those out if you missed them. This is this week's bonus episode where we are discussing Season 1 of the new Apple TV show, Severance. Severance is a science fiction psychological thriller TV show created by Dan Erickson and directed by Ben Stiller and Aoife McArdle. It stars Adam Scott, Zach Cherry, Britt Lauer, Trammell Tillman, Jen Tulloch, Ditchin Lachman, Michael Chernus, John Turturro, Christopher Walken, and Patricia Arquette. Severance is about a company who has made it possible for you to split your brain in two, a work brain and an at-home brain, or an innie and an outie, as they call it in the show. We'll get more in depth into that, but if you're wondering what the hell I'm talking about, refer to the spoiler warning and go back and watch the damn show, and you'll know what we're talking about. This show has gotten some great reviews, but we're not here for that. We're here to discuss what we think. So let's get into that now with our initial thoughts. Nyatva, as our guest, you get to go first. You want to introduce yourself a little bit and then give your broad initial thoughts on Severance Season 1?
Yeah, I love this show, and I know that we were speaking about it, like, between you and I, like, about how much we enjoyed it. I think that this show, and Ben Stiller, I think, did a really good job with the direction of the show. I think the cinematography was incredible. I think this, like, how it's in a certain way, like a conception of how our modern workplace is, and it's, you know, taken a little bit with an analogy, is really good. And I really enjoyed it from start to finish. There were twists at the appropriate times, and I pretty much enjoyed everything about it.
Awesome. Can't wait to get into some more of that, some of the finer details of that as we get into the discussion. Gardner, what are your broad initial thoughts on Severance Season 1?
Yeah, I mean, overall, I think this is one of, if not the best new shows this year. I was completely engrossed from start to finish. I was really, like Nyatva touched on, arrested by the visual style from the first episode. It has this very stark, bleak, very sanitized visual language that is very thematically relevant with Lumen, the work they do, how they're kind of sanitizing their workers' brains and making everything very uniform. I think it's very, very thematically strong. I can't praise the performances and the writing enough. I think, like you said, Niatafut has twists at the right times. It kept me engaged throughout the entire season. I was never bored. I was always on the edge of my seat waiting for what was coming next. And just very surprised by this show. I saw the trailers for it, and I heard like a couple things about it before it came out. And I wasn't really all that intrigued, but I just kind of gave it a shot and threw it on. And from then on, I was hooked, and I've been telling everybody to watch it since.
Yeah, I got to echo everything you guys say. I love this show. I was not surprised because as soon as I saw what it was about, I was hooked. I knew I was going to love it. This is what we describe as, and the audience may be a little sick of hearing this, but a Duncan show. Just like we have Duncan movies, we have Duncan shows, and this is right up my alley in the sense that it's sci-fi, it's twisty, it's always got you on the edge of your seat looking for twists, and it's playing with its sci-fi function in a really cool way. So everything about it is falls right into the category of what a Duncan film is and a Duncan TV show is. So I love it. I think the performances are great. It's got a great cast, some being A-list actors, some being, like we said before the recording, Gardner, you mentioned, really more of like C-list actors, but not in a bad sense, just in they don't have the notoriety that someone like Christopher Walken does, for example. It's interesting, as we mentioned, that I'd love to know where John Turturro actually falls in. Like, he's probably technically a B-lister, I guess. For me, I call him an A-lister because I love his work, but he does kind of fall in that gray area, I think, where there's a good amount of A and B-listers, I think, if you want to dice up the lines. Digression. I love what they do, like I said, with the sci-fi elements that they have. I think it's a great one. I can get bored with what is being given to me with new stuff a lot of times because I feel like a lot of stuff has been done already, and this is a new concept. It's not been done before, for sure. And obviously, the storytelling can only be as unique as it can be because there have been so many stories that have been told, but at least its core is good and new.
Yeah, I 100% agree with you. I mean, I didn't watch this show immediately. I wasn't excited about it. I didn't hear about it up front. I'm really happy that you were really pressing me to watch it because I certainly would not have otherwise. I haven't watched a lot of Apple TV shows recently, but this was probably one of the best shows of the past couple of years, I feel like, to be honest with you. I think that it was a really new story, like you mentioned, and like we don't get that very often, especially with film. There's so much rehashing of old stuff and remakes, and it's so rare that we see like a new take on something that's relevant to our time. Even you see the direction like Netflix is going, where it's like basically just reading out a Twitter timeline. It's really cool to see the direction that Apple TV is taking with this stuff, and I really, really enjoyed it. It's definitely one of my favorite TV shows the past couple of years.
And I have to say that I personally think that Apple TV is kind of killing it when it comes to the TV aspect, because I know, Niatafut, you put me on to For All Mankind, which I'm going to be pushing for us to when season 3 comes out, which might even be next year, so far down the line. But when that comes out, I'm going to be pushing for us to review season 3 of that as well, which I know that you'll be on for, Niatafut. Don't even have to ask about that. But yeah, that and this have combined to be great new TV for me. Like, what I'm excited about.
Yeah, spot on. I think it's a completely underrated streaming service. I was very skeptical of it at first when it first came out, because I mean, really all they had was like Ted Lasso. But once they started to dip more into getting these really strong prestige dramas, I'm completely sold. I'll drop Netflix for Apple TV because I'm a quality over quantity guy. And I like that they're not just pumping out a whole bunch of stuff, but they're focusing on really quality content. And I think Severance is really kind of the epitome of that. This is thoughtful, well done content. It's not stretched out, you know, so they could have 3 months of subscriptions, you know, with 20 episodes or something like that to keep you subscribing. It does what it needs to do. And it got renewed for a second season. And thank God. I cannot wait.
Now that we've got our broad thoughts out of the way, we can move on to a discussion of how the series actually goes, what happens in the episodes. We'll start with episode 1, titled Good News About Hell, which I guess is a little bit of a play on the first character that we meet, which is Heliar. and she is being integrated into the Severance program. She is the newest member of the Severance program because Petey, who is Mark's boy, has left and he is no longer part of the program. There's four members of the MDR group and Petey was the leader and now Mark is the leader. Mark is Adam Scott, so he's our main character who we're following. And we start off with that. He's introducing her into the Severance program at Lumen. Lumen is the name of the company. And we'll obviously learn more about Mark and Helly as we get throughout the series. But I do want to just mention that Mark, our main character, is his outie, who is his non-work version of him, is a widower. And he is caught up in that death. He's not happy with the death of his wife, which is sounds stupid for me to say because who is, but he's like really not dealing with it well. And you can see that in his outie, and you can see that he's not moved on from this, which is not to say that he necessarily should have, but I'm just noting that he's not handling this well. He is clearly going through it, and that's part of the reason why he joined the Severance program, was because the, what they say is that he wanted that version of him to be able to not have the memories of losing his wife, which is a little bit fucked up, because we'll get into what the work version of you, what that life looks like, but I don't know. Before we get into that, because I think that's where I do want to start a lot of the discussion, is like how fucked up this actual idea is. Do you guys want to talk about this introduction scene with Helly R?
Yeah, when it's like kind of a cold open, right? Like when she wakes up on the table and we're hearing this background noise and we have no idea what to think, having no idea what was going on in the show or the storyline or the plotline or anything going into the show. We're sitting there thinking, like, is this a focus group or something like that? We're prepared for something normal. And then, like, it does a really good job of setting us up for we have no idea what the fuck is going to happen throughout the series, I think. And the introduction of the character, Helly, who we don't know how important she is. Obviously, she be like, it's realized later on in the show who she is. But just having this idea that we're viewing a random woman just dropped out, you know, on a table. And we're like, what the hell is going on here? And I think that does a really good job of like kind of setting the tone for where the series is going to go. Because, I mean, realistically, we don't know what the fuck is going on in the whole show.
It's a great introduction for the audience to the concept of the show by putting us in the shoes of someone who's experiencing severance for themselves. Because as they learn about the process, so too does the audience. I think that was, I really don't think they could have done it any other way, because that way you get a lot of the exposition out of the way without it being clunky or confusing. It feels very natural. And also we get the amazing cinematography right out the bat. I mean, that top down shot of her on the table and just the symmetry and the artificial perfection of everything is there from the very first shot. And I think that is something that is a huge element of the show is Lumen is putting on like everything is so perfect, but there's something sickly about it. There's that kind of sickly green that pervades a lot of the shots in that early first few episodes that lets you know something is off here. It looks right, but it's not. And I just think this whole first episode is a brilliant pilot, one of the best pilots I've seen in a long time.
Yeah, I love the introduction to the characters. I think they're both well acted as well. And I mean, that's no surprise from an actor that I know in Adam Scott, but I haven't seen the actress who plays Helly R in really anything else. I know she's been in a good amount of stuff, but I'm not familiar with her, but she's phenomenal throughout the entire series so far. And it really stands out from the beginning, and her frustration with the process is well done by her. When we talk about the frustration with the process, let's get into the horror aspect of this sci-fi element, because it sounds well and good, because like if you're you, right, you're the outie, you get to work, it's 9 o'clock in the morning. You swipe in, you get in the elevator, and then a second passes and it's 5 p.m. and you're clocked out and you're good. And so you don't have to experience any of that bullshit, and it's great. Now, Here's the problem. There's another version of you that gets the exact opposite. They walk out of work and snap, they're walking back into work, which is quite literally the definition of hell. So kudos to the title of this episode being Good News About Hell, because that's what they're trying to do, is give them good news about what is essentially hell. And that's the aspect that I guess you'd have to either not think about, or you'd have to be a fucked up person to put yourself through. But I'd love to hear like some brief thoughts on how that goes down and what you guys think about that element of this sci-fi element.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of easy. The fucked up thing is like, it's kind of easy to relate to the outie, which is like kind of painted as the villain throughout the whole series, like implicitly. I think that all of us here would like to just not go to work and not experience work and experience all the benefits, the pay, you know, yada, 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 but not actually have to go. And obviously a lot of people in the show are dealing with personal issues and they kind of want to shut their brains off for that. But I mean, this show does a good job of painting both sides and how it explores the backstory of a couple of the main characters who are severed. But you also see at the high level, you know, the pain. And you're right, in Duncan, in saying that it is hell. Like, what if your whole world was just work? If you didn't leave, if your entire consciousness was that. And I think it does a good job of creating that, like illustrating how the bifurcation of the mind like affects both parties. Yeah, so I think that this show does a great job of illustrating the horror aspect of, you know, we're sitting here on the outside, hypothetically, as people who do not want to go to work. But at the same time, what that could, you know, the implications of that would be for, you know, every benefit has a cost, right? So I think that the show did a really good job illustrating that.
Yeah, 100%. I agree with that. I think it's very easy to empathize with the outie and be like, oh, I could see myself doing that. But the genius of the show is focusing on the innie and making you care about both simultaneously. And they do a really good job of that with Mark, having someone who's so broken in his quote unquote real life. Because I mean, these are both the innie and the outie, I think, are experiencing real life, just different versions of it. And having him be so broken, it makes you very empathetic to why someone would put themselves in that situation. And I love the this is where we get the dinner scene with Mark's sister and brother-in-law, and he gets kind of grilled by his brother-in-law's friends about, you know, why he did Severance and what's it like and how he feels about it. And it just, it does a great job of like building this drama between these two separate but similar characters that live in one body. It was something that when I was going into the show, I wasn't sure I'd be able to really care about. I was like, how are they going to make this work? We're going to have two separate plot lines with these two, you know, different versions of this guy's mind. But it ends up really, really driving the drama forward in sort of like a dramatic irony kind of way, where it's like, you know, the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing, but somehow they end up working in conjunction with one another and towards the same goal. It's, I'm just going to keep saying, you know, over and over again, how great it is, how masterful it is, because it really is spectacular.
And speaking about the dramatic irony of it all, I think that the end of this episode is when we meet Miss Cobell, his neighbor, who is actually Miss Selvig, his boss.
Yeah, huge shout out to Patricia Arquette in this series. I mean, she absolutely kills it. Her fading, freaky smile at the end of the pilot where she walks away, and because she walks up and, you know, they're kind of teasing it the whole time with, oh, Miss Selvig's calling me about the trash and da 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 da. And you're kind of like, why do they keep bringing this up? And then that reveal of who it is at the end of the first episode. And for a moment, you're not sure she's severed too, but the way her smile fades and she's got that stone expression on her face just kind of fills you with dread. And huge, huge shout out to Patricia Arquette in this series. She does an amazing, amazing job.
Yeah, throughout the show, I think I agree with you, Gardner, 100%. I think she did a really great job of playing both sides. I mean, it must be really tough in her own way. She kind of is severed in, like, balancing her work life and having to act with Mark Scott and his people and acting as, you know, she plays a couple of different roles, you know, throughout the show, in that she's the nanny or the doula or so she, yeah, I think she does a really good job in also, I think the direction did a good job in showing how she is playing this different role between being the doula for the baby and trying to, like, bring her work life home and taking over and investigating Mark Scott's life. And just her acting in general was incredible because she was playing multiple people. She was, you know, Patricia Arquette was playing, at the one point in time, the super hard ass boss. And then she was also playing, like, this really gentle doula. And but you could also see the edge to it at the same time. You know,
it's not easy. She's like playing a character who's playing a character.
Exactly. Exactly.
And that shit is hard.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I was getting after. Exactly. So the acting that goes into that, like, you're acting twice. Right. And so that's just insanely difficult. And I give a lot of respect to her for that.
Yeah. I see a lot of people talking about Adam Scott. I see a lot of people talking about, forgive me, I don't know his name, but the actor who plays Milchick, who did an absolutely fantastic job. I'm not discounting his performance, but she kind of gets overshadowed here in the discussion about the show, at least from what I've seen. And I think she deserves huge props.
Yeah. Trammell Tillman is who plays Milchick. And we also haven't mentioned that in this first episode, there is also the visit of Petey, who meets Mark's outie and tells him who he is. And we see that he has unsevered himself, where he could reintegrate his brain. And now he, from the outside, can remember what goes down on the inside, which is not only just a benefit to the employees so that they don't have to go through the work experience, it's also a benefit to the job because they're trying to be real hush-hush about what goes down at Lumen. Not that the severed versions of them actually know what the fuck is going on, because they don't, so I don't really know how much information they would have, but they are trying to withhold that cryptic information that they do have on the inside from the outside version as well. It's very, like I said, hush-hush.
Yeah, it feels like a CIA op of some kind where you've got, you know, all these different layers of security that might seem redundant, but we don't, you know, even by the end of the season, we don't really fully know what's going on there. So it's got to be something kind of nefarious in a sense to warrant all these levels of security.
Yeah, I mean, I remember texting Duncan, like, while this series is going on, obviously released on a weekly basis. I was like, what the fuck are these people doing? And then I realized after the show was, like, after the season was over, that it was probably intentional. You know, like, they're trying to make, like, an allegorical connection to how people just clock in, clock out at, like, you know, large, like, mega cap corporations, and they just see what exactly it is that they do. They're not necessarily concerned with the larger, perhaps nefarious intentions of the company as a whole. They're just stepping in, doing their job, with little to no regard for what actually might occur on the back end. So I thought that was intentional. I thought it was really good how we didn't see that in the first season, because I think that might have made it a little bit corny, you know, and then it becomes like a little bit action movie, like, oh, you know, these people are trying to stop the big company. Like, it becomes Die Hard. You know, we don't necessarily want that out of a sci-fi movie. We should, you know, let it develop over time. I think they did a really good job. And I think it was intentional, not letting us see everything that they're doing, you know, up front.
And there is a big risk of them going that route in season two and maybe season three, if it gets renewed past then, you know, that they feel the need. They need to explain all these mysteries and give all these motivations for why people are doing the things that they're doing at Lumen. What makes this show work, I think, is it's about, like, the horrors of bureaucracy and what people are capable of doing if, like you said, Niatafa, they just clock in and clock out, like, at these giant mega corporations. you're sort of given like a very granular, small role. And what you do is all that you're kind of aware of. And you go in and you do your job and you leave. But it's in service of something much grander and oftentimes harmful or nefarious. And though you're not directly necessarily responsible for what is going on up at that high level, you're an essential part of it. And that is why when you look at like some of the great horrors that have happened, like in humankind, bureaucracy is an essential tool at making those things happen. Because if you disconnect people and you've put enough steps and barriers between stages of like some great apparatus, you keep people from thinking about what is ultimately going on at the top too critically, and that allows it to go on and fulfill its purpose, you know, without anyone fully knowing what that is except for the people at the top. And that's ultimately really horrifying, because you can have great intentions and just be, you know, clocking into work and getting your benefits and providing for your family. But the unintended consequences of that, that you really don't have any control over, can be really, really awful. And, you know, they could explore that and they could tell us what that is at Lumen. And it all comes down to the writing. If it's well executed, that could still be really interesting. But for me, what makes this season so fascinating is the personal struggle against, no, I think I have a right to know what I'm doing.
Yeah, I think the payoff could end up being so cheap, and I do have faith that it won't be. I think that they're doing a really good job. They set a good precedent with the first season, and I think the payoff won't be cheap. And you know, it won't feel like this is going to end up being a Fast and Furious movie or something like that, because you can do the fight against an immovable object or an irresistible force and make that seem like, you know, whatever. Make it seem like these people are just, the good guys are going to win. But the show does a really good job in, by not showing us what exactly they're doing, it makes us kind of examine and do a little bit of self-reflection. Like, what role are we playing in the way that the Severed are in our own lives and our own jobs? And so you start thinking about things like, everybody will, if you read a little bit about, you know, war, like in war atrocities are going on, you'll say, hey, like, how could these people do these kind of things? Well, it's because they're disconnected, you know, from the higher mission, and they're just operating on, you know, the base level of humanity, whatever it is. We should cut all of this shit, because I'm just fucking speaking out of my ass right now. But I tie a bow on it in case it is actually good. It makes you think about how the greatest atrocities in humanity have been perpetrated by people who are just cogs in a machine. It's the show about bureaucracy. It's about how people can have, you know, unintended greater negative consequences while participating with good intentions. Like, Mark Scott just wanted to get away from the idea that his wife died. And who knows what the hell he's actually doing, you know, in this role. Just to get away from the fact that his wife died. So I think the show really makes you think about that by not giving you a cheap payoff at the end of season one.
And something we touched on earlier, talking about the why do they need to be severed if they don't even know what's going on? It's not just that they don't need to know, or that Lumen doesn't want them to know what's going on. Is they don't, you say they were to find out what was going on, they don't want them to have the tools to do anything about it. Severance is so important because these people are essentially born inside Lumen. I mean, you look at later in the season when Dylan attacks Milchick, what does he do? He bites him. That's something that 2 and 3-year-olds do. They don't have the emotional maturity. They don't have the tools. They can't go outside and find these resources to do something about it. So what they're presented with, their obstacle of this bureaucracy, is so consolidated and so confounding that it's essentially insurmountable. And that is what makes it work, is the confusion of what is the apparatus of the system for the people down at the bottom. And that's what works to the benefit of the people at the top.
Yeah, I mean, later on in the season, we hear Miss Casey say something along the lines of, I've been alive for 100 and something hours, which is such a horrific way to think about it, but it speaks to what you're saying, Gardner, about them being infantile and very childlike in their expression of feelings and stuff like that. And there's a reason why. I mean, like you said, they're basically born in there. And speaking on some of the ideas of people getting caught up and, you know, being so disconnected from it that they can be convinced to do awful things, which we're assuming that it's not just like making toothpaste or something, that they're doing something that's a little more sinister at Lumen. So I think it's interesting to look at Selvig as a character, because later on when she's fired, we see that meltdown and we see her shrine to Kier, and that she's not just bullshitting and getting these underlings to follow along and listen to the rules. She buys in and believes all this shit. And she's worried about what the board thinks, and for good reason, they fire her. But she's all in on an ideological sense, not just on a, I'm clocking in, doing my job, I gotta convince these guys of this bullshit so that they fall in line. She's totally believing it.
We serve Kier, you child. That's scary too. The zealot is always scary.
Zealots and anything are scary. And I feel like there's another, like, even deeper connection that's made there with the way that, like, a lot of people idolize or a lot of tech founders these days. Like, you know, Elon Musk has fanboys up and down the block. You know what I'm saying? And the way that people can turn that sort of thing into a religion with Bezos and, you know, Musk and whoever, the way that these people are sort of treated, and Steve Jobs as well, like how they're treated as like larger than life. And I think that the show is kind of drawing a little bit of a parallel to that as well. Maybe not Jobs because it's an Apple TV show, but still.
Maybe. I mean, you know, he wasn't innocent. Obviously, they're not going to. I think that might be something that's indirect on the part of the filmmakers. But I think that's a great point. People who buy into this sort of ideology, hook, line, and sinker. It's scary, man. There's no like real critical thinking. I have a lot of thoughts about Cobell and the board. Maybe we'll get into a little bit down the line.
Yeah, let's get into some of the earlier stuff that happens, because in episode 2, we have Helly trying to quit. She tries to do a resignation from her Audi, which they've let her know it never really works, but she tries anyway, and she gets rejected big time by her Audi. And we also get a little bit more of Dylan and Irving, who are played by Zach Cherry and John Turturro. And that's the four. It's Mark, Dylan, Irving, and Helly in Microdata and Refinery, MDR. So she's putting like scary numbers into, that's what it's described as, scary numbers into different bins. And I think in the first episode is when they talk about like the reward system, which is a great example of like how Jobs kind of like try to like trick you into thinking you're getting something when it's like the biggest bullshit ever. And Zach Cherry's character, Dylan, is super into it. He buys into it. And some of the like the later stuff, like when he was talking about like the egg bar and stuff and how it's coveted as fuck. Gardner, I know you love that line. He is in on every level on all the rewards. And even like when he like jumping ahead, he's helping them reconnect to themselves, become their innie versions in the outside world. And he's the only one there in that locked room. And we have Milchick trying to get into him. He's trying to coax him with more rewards. Like, there's rewards you don't even know about. There's paintball, Dylan. There's paintball. And like he knows like how to get to Dylan. But Dylan's like, I want to see my fucking kid, which we'll get to that too, because that's another part of the horror where it's like you have a whole family that you don't even know about. But other things that happen in episode 2, we have Irving gets a wellness check and he's met by Ms. Casey, who gives him nice facts about himself in the wellness check, which is like, I thought was kind of weird. It's like, well, you don't get to benefit from it. It's like things like, when you walk in a room, everyone else, when your Audi walks in a room, everyone is happy. It's like, what the fuck good does that do me? You know, that's what I'm looking at it as. But the ending of this is, I believe, where Petey is having like hallucinations and stuff from the reintegration sickness. And he's with Mark at Mark's house, and he kind of collapses at the end in the shower.
Yeah, so I think like the whole the wellness check thing was absolutely fucking insane because it was like, we're gonna tell you things that you know about somebody that isn't really about yourself that you will never meet, but is also yourself and what they do to try and make you feel good about yourself. And like you said, Duncan, it's like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, that doesn't do anything for me. And for Irving, I guess it made him feel good about himself because he was so super bought into the whole philosophy. But as somebody that is like going to be skeptical of that as a watcher of the TV, a watcher of the TV show, you're thinking like, this is like pedantic. Like, what the fuck are these people talking about? It doesn't mean anything. And I think that's how we were meant to see it. The whole reintegration sickness is like, is this guy retiring? How are we supposed to look at this? And it, you're just looking at, like, at least the way that I looked at it was like, how am I supposed to relate this? Because I pretty much clocked in the beginning, or we're making a commentary about our modern workplace. How am I supposed to look at reintegration sickness through the lens of an everyday worker? And I never really came to an answer about that, but I'd be curious to hear what y'all think. Well, we were supposed to think about it.
That's a good question. I don't have like any sort of allegory that immediately springs to mind, but that's definitely a really good concept that the show brings up. That there's a lot of things that the show brings up that I feel like are sort of ethereal and aren't necessarily meant to be answered right away, but sort of something for you to ponder and draw your own conclusion on it. I would feel dishonest if I was like, oh, this is what that means, you know, pulling that out of my ass. I don't know, but it definitely intrigues me and I want to explore that more.
I feel like it's closest to tripping, like doing some shrooms or taking some acid, if anything. Like, he's experiencing things from a different time at this time, which is not necessarily what tripping feels like, but it's fucked up things that aren't actually going on that he's experiencing.
Yeah, and he's having like all these sorts of revelations and connecting it to different parts of his life and therefore having some sort of epiphany, right? Which is kind of what a lot of people experience on psychedelics. You learn something about yourself or about life, or you walk away with a new perspective.
Yes, like even like outside of like psychedelic experiences, which, you know, can, you know, are supposed to be able to like make you achieve certain, you know, certain thought processes and make you aware of certain things. I think even necessarily, or even not necessarily at that level, maybe it's just like awakening to the idea that your job is bullshit and like, what do you really mean? And what are you clocking in and clocking out for? What are you here to achieve? And if you can find meaning in what good that your job brings to you, then that's all well and good. But I think that what they were trying to explore was some sort of the idea that when you clock the idea that your job is bullshit and you come to the realization that you're sitting here spending so much time for no real like societal good, it's not a good feeling. And I think that that's probably what the root of the what's it called? Reintegration sickness was.
I don't know why it makes me think of that saying, like, if you want to change your life, change your life. Where a lot of people sit around and they're just kind of unhappy and they wish things were different, but they keep doing the same old thing, just hoping that something will come along and change it. But that's not how it works. They have to go out and do it themselves. I don't really know how I'm going to connect that to that, but just you talking about that right then, it made me think of that. And, you know, fuck it. He went and changed it. And there were dire consequences, but he did the damn thing.
That's absolutely right. I mean, and to a certain extent, it kind of gave me like 1984 vibes, right? Like, when you read 1984 as somebody that lives in, you know, the 21st century, you're like, oh, this has this correlation with how we see this world right now. This is what we're seeing, but what can we actually do about it? Like, I've figured out that some shit is fucked up. Like, what does that even really mean? And you can know it's fucked up, but what are you going to do about it? And that can make you sick as well. And maybe they were trying to go, obviously the whole show is like pretty dystopian, but maybe that's the kind of direction they were trying to go. Like, you figure out that you're your situation is fucked up, that your world is fucked up. Like, what can you do? And maybe that powerlessness is what they were trying to get after.
So on to In Perpetuity, which is the name of episode 3. Here we get the no from Helly's Audi, the resounding no, where she tells her, I'm a person, you're not, and other things. Just real fucked up shit. And we also get Petey running from Mark's house because he's afraid of Selvig. And we also get the suggestion from Irving for them to go to the Perpetuity Wing, which is like a history wing on the Egan family. And we see Kier's home, among other things, among some statues of the former Egans who led the company, stuff like that. And we also get Dylan talking about the rumors of the coup that was put on by Optics and Design, because we've met Christopher Walken's character and we've seen, I think it was in episode 2, the blossoming relationship between him and John Turturro's character Irving, which obviously develops later on into the series and has a little bit of a tragic ending, but we can get to that in a little bit. This episode seems to not have too much that we need to get into. If you guys want to touch on any of those points, we can before I get into episode 4.
Other than the fact that I'm a big fan of Bert and Irving, I think that was a great decision on the writer's part. It gives, because Irving is very, very much like kind of Cobell-esque in the fact that he's very bought into reverence for Kier and the work we do is mysterious and important. And then the loss of Bert, you know, he experiences these feelings he's never felt before. And then when Bert retires, it gives him the kind of push to rebel. I thought that was a really well done arc. I liked that every character had an arc throughout here. I just think overall, this is really, really tight filmmaking throughout the season.
So chapter 4 in the series, episode 4, is the you are. Irving and Bert's relationship blossoms even more in this. And Helly attempts to escape. And Rickon's book, which was brought to the office by Selvig, is discovered by the MDR team. And also we should note that in episode 3 and 2, we have Helly trying to sneak out notes to her Audi. And Mark kind of squashing those attempts, but not really having to squash those attempts, just telling her that those attempts are going to be squashed anyway by the machines that scan you in the elevators. So that's a little bit of a note there. Petey passes away and has a funeral, and Mark attends that and meets his daughter.
This was a great sequence. I love when he runs into Selvig there, and there's that whole tension of her trying to get the implant out of Petey's head and Mark walking in. I mean, there's a lot of like little quiet moments in this show, but then it snaps you back to the horror of what's going on. And that's one of those. The whole drilling into his head is very visceral, and the sound there with the crunching and I don't even want to think about it too much. And I really liked the interactions between Mark and Petey's daughter. It does a great job. I mean, it's already done a really good job of like humanizing the innies, but I like that this experience for Audi Mark is like very transformative. Like, this is a big moment for him in deciding, okay, yeah, I'm going to go like full steam ahead on going after Lumen now.
Just to address what you said, Duncan, I think I was personally kind of shocked in that initial scene where Helly's Audi is basically like, go fuck yourself. Like, I was not expecting that reaction at the point in time on first viewing. I mean, perhaps I should have seen that it was like a longer show and like there would have been some conflict that would have arisen from that. And maybe it was too early for her to get off that easy, so to speak. But I was kind of shocked because I figured that, and obviously this paid off in the end with when we find out who Helly really was on the outside. But episode 4 was definitely impactful from like a scene setting and like, what are we all doing kind of standpoint.
Yeah. And obviously we end the episode with Helly's attempted suicide, where she has an extension cord and she brings it into the elevator and tries to hang herself. I thought she was dead.
I thought she was dead too, man. Like, this was, I think I caught up when, I think this is when I first started watching, when I finally bought into it, when you were trying to get me to watch it. And I caught up to this point and I was like, holy shit, I can't wait another week for this.
Right.
You know, I really thought that she was going to be dead. And the whole, I'm an innie, I'm an outie, I'm an innie, I'm an outie. And that whole scene was insane. I thought they did a really good job with that. Like, she went between consciousness, like, very fluidly, like, as she was trying to kill herself. I think that's when I really bought into the show as being, like, this is doing something. You know, maybe that's, like, kind of morbid or whatever, but I was not expecting that at all from, you know, just tuning into a TV show and going through what seemed to be, like, a workplace drama with a little bit of weird wrinkles to it. And then it was like, okay, like, they're going to explore something a little bit meta here. And like, that's when I finally, like, when the hook was really set with me, when I realized then that there's going to be a lot of exploration here. And I couldn't wait until that next Friday, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, and obviously she does survive. We find that out in episode 5, The Grim Barbarity of Optics and Design. In this episode, Devin, Mark's sister, is giving birth in a weird cabin lodge, which is definitely up Rickon's alley. Definitely feels like a him move that he was pulling for that one for sure. And inside, we have more Optics and Design talk. Obviously, the entire episode is called The Grim Barbarity of Optics and Design. But in the previous episode, we discovered that there was more people in Optics and Design than Bert had previously said there were. They have actually 7 other employees, I believe it is. And here's where we have Milchick doing a little bullshit. It's called a 266 that he runs on Irving, where he, quote unquote, accidentally has a painting printed to the printer that Irving is using. And that's the painting called The Grim Barbarity of Optics and Design. And it shows a coup, or the supposed coup, where they're massacring people from MDR.
That was another thing I thought was really... there's so much shit that's like, what the fuck is really going on here? And when we see the suicide, and obviously Hallie like made it out okay, but looking at this coup, like with that sequence of events, like back to back, you're sitting there thinking like, how morbid is this show really? Like, what the hell is going on here? And I think they did a good job. Like, obviously this is kind of like the rising action, like all the shit has been set thus far, and we're trying to figure out what is going on with this company. And you start to really think about all the implications of what is actually occurring at the company.
I like the detail of them pitting departments against one another. Again, just another layer to obfuscate what's really going on, keeping departments away from each other. There can be no communication across departments. That's a huge no-no, because communication can lead to cooperation, which can lead to revolution. Which comes up later when they lock MDR into their office and don't let them out, because it's too disruptive for them to have relationships with people in O&D. You know, because we later see that they have an exact copy of that painting, but with the badges switched so that it's MDR attacking O&D. And those kinds of mind games are essential for a kind of tyrannical authoritarian power structure to work like this. You've got to keep the masses divided in order for power to remain consolidated at the top. I think there's a lot of very relevant social commentary in this show that is not just coincidental, but very, very, very intentional. At times I'm like, damn, Apple let them get away with this? Because, you know, they're a large corporation. I'm sure they have a lot of workers who feel like they might be living in any kind of life. But the show does a fantastic job of, again, illustrating the dangers of that kind of banality and what it can lead to.
I'm not sure what episode it is exactly that they find out about the self-help book that Mark Scott's brother-in-law created, but that's when the parallels to the real world and that working environment were like stark clear. Okay, you're looking at unionization effectively, right? That's how it ended up looking like. And you were revolting against It's not the proletariat. It's not the
bourgeoisie.
Okay, yeah. So they find out about the self-help book, and all of a sudden it's the parallels are super clear. You know, this is like a proletariat situation in the bourgeoisie, like revolting against the bourgeoisie. So like you said, Gardner, I mean, it is extraordinary clear how, like, the, I mean, it's either one or two, depending on when you listen to this, the most valuable companies in the world is kind of letting this go by as a commentary on worker and capital situations, because it seems like a pretty, you know, emphatic condoning, or if not, you know, encouraging of a worker revolt, you know.
And we see it doesn't really work, because the end of this episode is Bert introducing them to the full optics and design team in the back room. So they kind of come to the conclusion that, yeah, they're fucking with us, because there's communication. I think it's interesting to talk about how there is communication, and they kind of have a little discussion about, look, the badges are switched in the pictures. Whereas a lot of times in real life, there isn't that communication. Lack of communication can lead to a lot of problems. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's like the purpose of Dylan's character there is to be like, he's been fed that line. Right. So he's very standoffish until he sees that. He doesn't even want to communicate with them because he's been so thoroughly brainwashed.
And so we also have Helly and Mark working on recreating Petey's map, which was shredded by Mark earlier on. And so we can move on to episode 6 titled Hide and Seek. In this one, we have Ms. Casey going to the break room. We didn't really talk about the break room too much earlier, where it's, again, like torture, like within hell being tortured, where you have to say a phrase and mean it. And when Helly was in there, it took her like hundreds of times to do it. I think she maybe thousands. But Mark feels bad because Ms. Casey was sent to the break room. We see a little bit of a connection here. Obviously, we know later on that Ms. Casey is his quote unquote dead wife. So it's interesting to see them have this connection. And it is interesting also to have like Dylan hitting on her in the background the entire time.
Yeah, that break room was pretty illuminating, because again, and I keep drawing these parallels, you're sitting there thinking about what lines of bullshit am I being fed, you know, made to repeat over and over internally that make me think a certain way. You know, I'm a rational person. What am I, like, in the Helly was portrayed this way as well. What am I just led to believe through pain? And I'm out here sounding like a fucking unionizer. What am I led to believe just by force of repetition, by force of waking up every morning and doing, you know, going to my job that I may not necessarily even believe in the first place? I think the break room was a continuation of the darker turn of the show, where we're exploring how, as people who we go to work and we may not necessarily believe in what we're doing, but the greater good of the company was in Helly, in this instance, being broken mentally and just made to repeat certain things until she honestly may have, and if it was repeated several times, she may have ended up believing it herself.
We also have Irving and Bert trying to get a little kissy-kissy, and Irving being like, no, a little too soon, I'm not ready to take it to the next step. He's all bought in, just like Dylan's all bought into the ideas of the reward system. Irving is bought into like the handbook and those rules, and he's always quoting the handbook. And he does so in telling Bert that he's not ready for it. And I do like that Bert also kind of counters with, like, he's like, oh, I actually like, and this might be in a different conversation actually, but Bert says in a conversation that, oh, I actually know, I've been around so long that I know an older version of the handbook, which actually said something a little different, which actually implied that maybe this would be fine. And, you know, I think later on it's revealed or shown to Irving that Kier met his wife when they were working together. So what's wrong with Bert and Irving? I love the whole Bert and Irving relationship. That's why I keep bringing it up. Two powerhouse actors you got there too, so it's hard not to. But I am maybe harping a little too much on the Bert and Irving right now. But we also have in this episode the woman who Devin met giving birth, after she gave birth, not recognizing her now. And she's the wife of a pro-severance senator, I believe. And this is where the idea starts creeping in. I mean, immediately when she's not recognizing her, I'm like, severed, 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 for sure.
she gave the baby a different name.
Right. It's a different name than what she said she wanted to name it, which is interesting. I guess the severed version had a different idea for the name. But it's interesting because it's like totally. I mean, you think the rich and powerful wouldn't be using this for things like giving birth? And we even hear later on the woman who is the liaison between the board and Selvig talking to Heliar and saying like, oh, I could never have given birth to two or three kids, whichever it is, without being severed. So we get kind of confirmation on that later on, too, if there was any doubt in your mind that it's being used for other things, not just the workplace, which, again, that's world building because it would be, right? We also have Kobel / Selvig becoming the midwife for Devin and Rickon. And the stinger of the episode, the final note that we end on, is Mark answering Petey's phone and being contacted by the person who unsevered him. I think we can probably move on to episode 7, which is called Defiant Jazz.
Gets its title from a fantastic scene. I love that scene. This is the scene, right, where Milchick is dancing around and he gets in Dylan's face.
Yeah, that was really interesting. Just like how I think that Miss Selvig showing up in Mark Scott's personal life and investigating was a little bit of like an exploration into how your work creeps into your personal life. This was so weird, but the cinematography was so good, like with the lights, it was so disorienting. But at the same time, you're sat there thinking, like, you're enjoying how well the scene has been shot with all the lights, the dancing, him getting up, like you said, in Cherry's face. And I think there was just that line that was drawn between the two.
So this is one of my gripes with the series, and maybe you can refresh my memory on this, Duncan, but I feel like the reintegrator, she kind of shows up and then is dropped. And I was left kind of wondering the rest of the season, like, what happened with her? Where did that go? And maybe I'm forgetting something crucial, but I feel like either they kind of forgot about it or it wasn't that important, or it's going to be a bigger, more important role in season 2.
It feels to me like an overarching thing that'll be brought back in later seasons. You're not forgetting anything that I'm aware of.
Okay, good. Yeah. So I could see that being something that plays out more in season 2 is the reintegration. Is it possible? Because obviously that's a huge part of Cobell's story, is going back and forth with the board and saying, hey, guess what? Someone's achieved reintegration, even though they didn't consider it possible.
And we should mention, we kind of briefly touched on it earlier, but there was a scene earlier where they had to wake Dylan up outside of his job. And he met his son then, because his son ran into the room and gave him a hug. And so now he knows he has a son and a family. And we touched on the horrors of that earlier, kind of. But here we have Dylan attacking Milchick because of the anger that he's harboring because of that, because he is still mad about the fact that that happened. And he tells the rest of the team that that can happen, that they're able to do that. And this is what starts the plan for what we get in the finale, where they know that they can do that so they can be woken up outside of it. So they want to do that later on as part of their plan.
Yeah, it seems so pedantic. And I think that a lot of people can probably identify with what Dylan is feeling. Like, I have a life outside of this shit, dude. What, you want to give me a jazz party once in a while to make me forget about the idea that I have a family outside of this and just expect me not to acknowledge that? I think that it was very visceral and real, his reaction when he finally just snapped on Milchick. I thought that was really good.
It also feels like a very direct commentary on demanding bosses and demanding work schedules that literally take you away from your family and strip you of that very valuable time that you're absolutely never going to get back.
Yeah, I don't think it's lost that it's called overtime contingency. So it's a little shot at maybe bosses who want you to work too much overtime.
Oh, I think 100%. Yeah.
Yeah. What was it? And like, I mean, their range of rewards are like waffle party, and you can have this little shit on your desk. And if you're really good, you can get a party where they play a little bit of music, and it just feels like bullshit because like you're not actually making me feel good about, like, nothing can replace the time that he spends with his kid, that he, despite the fact that he's at work, feels a very clearly strong connection to.
Yeah, nothing that they offer you is actually meaningful or useful in any way. It reminds me of working retail, and it'd be like, oh, congrats, we all worked just the most horrible shifts of our lives because it was a holiday. Here, have some free pizza. So I go, yeah, great. Could you pay me more? Could I get an extra day off? No. Okay, free pizza. Great. Thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it is extremely intentional. Maybe this is as most heavy-handed as the show gets in terms of making a corollary between, you know, the show and the severed guys with the commentary on real life and real life work-life balance. But I think it was still pretty well done in that it was so obvious how, like, the viewer is thinking, this is bullshit. You want to give me a jazz party? I'm what's it called? MDR viewer of the quarter or whatever it is. And I'll get a little bit of music in the office to make me feel happy about it. Like, the viewer's sitting there thinking, like, yeah, that's bullshit. And then you sit there and think, like, oh, what am I being fed? And what little shit is my boss doing that makes me think that, you know, this is a little bit, little reward that doesn't cost anything to the company that is supposed to make me feel good, but, like, it's not at all meaningful for the life experiences that I've lost.
Yeah, totally. And so here we get Irving going to OND to check on Bert and finding out that Bert is actually retiring and thinking that this is a retaliation against them and their fraternization. And he actually refers to it as killing him, which I think is very interesting coming from such a devout listener and follower of the handbook, that he's referring to it as killing him. Because that is, that's, I mean, like, we called it birthing them before. They're born at Lumen. So then once you're not working there anymore and there's no more any, that version's effectively killed. It's true. And so we get that, and then we get the real ending of the episode, which is something that I was, like, texting you guys immediately about afterwards once you guys had seen it, where we find out when Devin's friend, Alexa, who Mark has been casually seeing, meets up with him, and he's, like, wasted, and he's like, look, I don't even care about my wife. I shouldn't have talked about her that much, yada, yada, rips up a photo of her. Alexa leaves. Then we, as the audience, get to see him putting that photo back together, and we see who it is. And it's Ms. Casey. And that's dope.
Yeah, that shit went over my head. Well, the first time I watched it, I didn't even realize that that's who it was in the photo. So, like, later, I think it was, like, the next week, and I was, like, reading the discussions online was when the pieces finally clicked together. And I felt so stupid that I didn't make that connection.
Yeah, that's why you're going to chime in here. Didn't you not notice either?
Okay, yeah, like Garner, it went over my head a little bit at first. I think since it was the end of the episode, maybe I checked out a little bit because I felt like I'd seen all I needed to see to a certain extent. But I think they rehashed it in the next episode and we're like, yo, that is Miss Casey. Miss Casey is Mark Scott's wife. Are they bringing back the dead? Like, what is going on? What is going on with this thing? Like, what is the actual backstory that's happening here? And the fact that I think that's where maybe it gets a little bit too TV, you know, like, they didn't have to make that so heavy handed and obvious. Like, how many people, like, she's been alive for 100 hours. Like, we've got anybody in the world to do this job, hypothetically, anybody that was going to be severed, at least. It becomes a little bit heavy handed there, I feel like. But it's probably good TV on the back end because we're getting a little bit more of an intricate plot line. And I think the plot twist was okay. It's probably the worst plot twist that we've seen in the TV show, but it's not the worst possible thing. I didn't see it coming for sure, but maybe on second rewatch, there was some Easter eggs that made it pretty clear that was going to happen.
Duncan, I know you thought so. I remember you texting me and being like, oh, there was a line of dialogue that made you think, oh, yeah, his wife is definitely still alive. I, for one, kind of wanted her to stay dead, but that's just me.
Yeah, I think it was in the same episode. It might have been in the week before, but there was something that happened where someone said to him, well, your wife is dead, Mark. And I was like, that line, Reed, I was like, you're emphasizing it too much. I was like, she's alive. And I definitely didn't think it was, like, Ms. Casey. I had no idea who it was going to be, but I was like, she's alive. I did think so. And I like the twist. I think it's going to work with the show. I think they're going to convince us why it works. But I see where you're coming from, Yatsuba, where it's a little bit TV, for sure. I see that.
Yeah, like, we all want to, like, this show did a really good job of making us see the natural A to B to C cause and effect of the plot line thus far. And then it's like, oh, okay. The person that we've been seeing and is super mysterious and seems like this tortured soul is actually the person that the main character is super tortured about. hopefully they do give us that payoff that's rewarding in the end. But at least on first watch, it seems super cheap. We just need a little bit more backstory, I think.
I think we'll get there. We'll see. So in episode 8, What's for Dinner, it's called, because they want to find out what's for dinner, right? They're going to find out what they're having for dinner tonight because their plan is to wake themselves up on the outside, like we mentioned earlier. So they need the whole team to get to 100% for MDR to reach their quota for the quarter. And we see that at the beginning, they're all stressing out. Is she going to make it? Is she going to make it? She's like sweating. She's doing it. She gets it done. They all celebrate. And we have Cobell talking to Mark, being like, oh, you had us worried, but you did it. You made it. All right. And then who are you going to pick for the reward? And he's like, oh, I was thinking I'm going to pick Dylan. And she's like, you know, you could pick yourself or like anyone that's not Dylan, for example, because like she was like clearly like kind of implying that Dylan's an annoying guy and like you shouldn't reward him, basically. Anyway, he picks Dylan, which is obviously part of the plan. We find that out later. And she also tells him that he's going to do a special wellness session with Ms. Casey that she's having. Well, she tells him that she's having all the department heads do, but it's really just for him. And here's where we see that interaction with them. They still don't recognize each other, which is like, duh. That's what Severance is, right? That's like the whole fucking deal. But we have that conversation between Milchick and Cobell where she is like disappointed. And he's like, you know, that means it works. Like, it's a good thing. Like, that's like the whole idea here. And I was thinking the same thing as him. I was like, yeah, like, duh. And Casey sent back down to the testing floor. And this is when we have Cobell suspended by the board and removed from her position. And this is when she freaks out. She goes home. She rips apart the Kier shrine that she has. And she's freaking out, crying. And we see Mark's Audi arrives there and is like, hey, you want to go to Rickon's book reading with me? And I love the acting in this scene because she seems so like crazy in it. And she's like, yes. And if I feel sick, if I feel bad, I'll bring my own car. And like, I just love the entire thing. And so they go to Rickon's house. Mark goes there and Miss Selvig, I should say, I guess not Cobell here because she's in character, meets him there. And so they're at the party and we have Dylan getting ready to flip the switch. And here we have, it's showing us what that prize is for Dylan, and it's sex. It's a little weird, like sex orgy with masks on, like Egan related masks, it seems like. And like one of them is like an old woman. It's clearly an older Egan. And it's like the whole thing is very like somewhat off-putting, just weird in general. I mean, if you're into that kind of stuff, you're into that kind of stuff. So good on you, but it's definitely not your vanilla sex experience. I'll say that about it. And here we have him run away with the whip, which he's going to use to help him pull the levers. Which, whenever there's something like this in media, here's my biggest complaint with the entire thing is the levers wouldn't be close enough for him to be able to do it. That's the whole fucking idea of the levers. Like, they would be, like, across the room from each other. Like, that's their one function, isn't it? To stop you from being able to do what you're doing right now. So, like, and you see him, like, really stretching. He's not even a tall guy. So he's a knockout of big wingspan, for sure. Like, he should not be able to pull this off, is my biggest complaint with the entire season. I love the show.
I think I heard his Audi does muscle shows.
Oh, I forgot about that. I did forget about that. Yeah. And he is like banging a bunch of MILFs that he feels kind of bad about.
Yeah.
Although it is badass. But anyway, small gripe where it's like anytime, because they do it in media like a bunch of times. Like it's not the first time that someone's been able to press both buttons at once or pull both levers at once. And it's every time it happens, I'm like, no, don't think of a different problem for them to solve because you can't solve that one with one person. Anyway.
A little bit TV here as well, like the whole setup, the drama. It felt that it did feel a little bit contrived. You know, he's literally sweating, holding these things together. You know, it felt really TV, which maybe is a knock, but also, you know, hey, these people know what they're doing, and maybe there'll be some payoff to it. But in the moment, it was like, okay, guy. You're the one person that was left behind, probably the shortest dude or the shortest person in the office. And it's your job to hold these fucking levers together. And we're watching you sweat and watching the suspense build at the same time, at like literally in real time.
And so we have, like I said, Mark and Cobell at the book reading party, and they're talking right as the levers are pulled.
And that's where the episode ends. It ends with the levers being pulled. But right before that happened, and right before Mark's innie became his outie, took over the outie's body, he was talking about how he was about to make a big life change. And that change is that he was going to leave his job at Lumen. And this is what kind of gives him away, because then Cobell is like thinking about like what's he talking about? Like, she notices that he's off and stuff like that, and she like brings it up later, like, oh, like, did you really mean that? And he's like, yeah, whatever, like, sure. And it's like clear, like, to someone who was paying attention, which she was, that he's someone different now, right? And then he blows it later on. I mean, I'm getting to episode 9 now. I will properly introduce it in a second, but he totally blows it by calling her the wrong name as well. But that's how it ends, with them about to become their innies in the outside world. So on to episode 9, the we are, starts with us getting confirmation. Not starts immediately, but one of the beginning things people were wondering is, Helly one of the Egans? I know, Gardner, you said that was one of the theories that was going around. She is. She is one of the Egans. She was at that fancy dinner, and that's what she was there for. She's an Egan. And also, we have Mark now at that dinner party, as is Innie, with his boss. Worst case scenario. Here we have Irving kind of shelved, though, a little bit, because he does the one thing that they said not to do, which is not to get too focused on your goddamn outside life. Irving totally drops the ball here, dude. I love his character, but come on, man, be better than what you do here. Fucking following Bert around and finding out that he has a husband. This is the tragic ending, not only just the retiring, but then the finding out that he has another lover already on the outside world. So it's a doomed relationship to begin with. But yeah, that's where we start this episode off with.
Yeah, I think that it was very, like, third act of James Bond here in this last episode, wherein, like, you can almost hear the cliche 80s action music going on with, you know, the suspense that's continually building, the periodic cuts back into Dylan and all this and that. But when Helly R was cornered in the bathroom by who we find out is her dad, when she's cornered by her dad, we're sitting there thinking, like, what the fuck do I even do in this situation? Like, she's going to sit there and speak to a group of people as somebody who she actually, like, fucking hates. And we're watching Irv fuck the whole thing up, like you said, Duncan. And all of the shit that's going on, Mark be dealing with this stuff as well. And eventually, obviously, Miss Selvig finds out what the deal is. But, I did get the impression that it was a little bit, we're doing this for the sake of adding suspense. But although at the same time, when you're thinking about it, these people were just dropped into a situation. They literally have no idea what's going on. It's like waking up in a different body and trying to accomplish a goal that you have no preparation for. So in that way, I think maybe the suspense was a little bit good.
I thought this episode was brilliant. I loved the suspense. To me, it played out very realistically of what would you do if all of a sudden you just woke up and you didn't really know who you were. You didn't really know who the people around you were, but you have some sort of goal that you have to try to accomplish. It's tough. The littlest things are going to be inconveniences. And I love how clever Mark is in his storyline here, is sussing out who he can trust, identifying his sister, and then going to her and telling her everything. That was the best thing he could have done. Of course, that probably spells a lot of danger for her and Rickon in the future. Thank God the baby's okay. That had me really nervous for a while.
Yeah.
But I think this is, the pilot is one of the best pilots I've seen in a long time. And this finale is one of the best finales I've seen in a long time. As soon as it ended, I wanted to be severed and skip ahead to next year where I can just go ahead and watch season 2.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, dude. Absolutely. Like, especially with the ending, and not to skip ahead, so I'm not going to do that right now. We can address it when the time comes. But holy God, they did a good job of portraying what it would feel like to wake up and Helly R is now sitting here portraying her worst, like literally portraying her worst enemy, and she makes the decision not to. I didn't think that she was going to do that. I thought she was going to try and run with it and try and figure out a little bit more stuff. But just the pacing, we're watching Helly R like be confronted with pictures of her own face as somebody that she doesn't know who she is. Like, all that I think was really, like, it contributed a great deal to the impression that the viewer got of the finale. And I think it was really well done in the end.
And they did a good job not dragging out the episode either. I think this is one of the shortest episodes in the in the whole season. It was like 45 minutes or something like that, like 42, something like that. It was short, but it felt like it was 20 minutes. I mean, it was so jam-packed with stuff going on, and not in a way where it felt overstuffed, just that it felt right.
Yeah, and we can really just talk about the ending now. It is the big two moments are Mark blowing his cover, calling her Miss Cobell instead of Selvig, and then the ensuing escape by her to go warn everyone at Lumen, the finding of the baby, and then the finding of the photo by Mark. But before that, we get Cobell / Selvig at Lumen, running into Heli, telling her not to do it, telling her that they'll torment all of her friends, they'll keep them alive and torture them, and that she'll be gone. And she decides to go through with it. Like you said, Nyatva, you were not sure that she was going to. I never doubted it for a second. I thought that that was her only option. I thought it would have been a pussy move to not do that. But she does. She gets on stage and says, no, this is all fucked up. Like, listen to me. Everyone's laughing at her at first. They think it's a joke. But she's like, no, I'm the innie. They start, like, tackling her, getting her off stage. And that's the ending for her. And then the real ending of the entire season is Mark finding the photo of Ms. Casey and running out right as he's about to become unsevered again, or like become the outie again. He gets the chance to yell out, she's alive, to Rickon and the company there. And that's how the episode ends and how the season ends. So if you guys have any final thoughts on this final episode and the season as a whole, before we get into our actual final thoughts, speak now.
I just hope we get some redemption for any Dylan next season. Tough break, sacrificing yourself for everyone else, especially for Irving to kind of blow it the way that he did. I want him to meet his kid. Other than that, though, great ending to this season. Really, really is one of those episodes that leaves you wanting more. It's tough to stick an ending, but they absolutely did.
Yeah, they absolutely crushed it in terms of making you want to be severed, like you said, Gardner, for a year and change waiting for season two. With the pacing, Ben Stiller really did a good job with his direction in this episode. And I think that all of us are sat here waiting for more.
So that does bring us to our final section of the show. Now that we've touched on everything that happens in season one of Severance, maybe not everything, but all the major plot points that we thought of. If you think of anything that we didn't mention, feel free to send us a message on Twitter or Instagram. We'll get to that later, where you can reach us out there. But right now, it's time for final thoughts and ratings. Nyatva, you do get to go first. You get to bring your own unit for your rating. And we do rate out of 10 for TV shows here on GDT. Feel free to bring a decimal, though. It doesn't have to be a flat number. But so, yeah, what are your final thoughts and your rating of Severance Season 1?
So, like I touched on in the beginning, I really love how this show is taken in a direction at all. Like, from almost episode to episode, we were surprised. And I think that I was not expecting what I received. I think it was one of the best shows of the past few years, absolutely. And I'm really excited to see where it goes in season two. I want to see perhaps a little bit of Cobell backstory. Obviously, I want to see what happens with Heli. I think Irving is maybe not so much longer for this world, but I think the Heli and Mark story is going to get fleshed out a little bit more. I'm excited to see that. I really want to find out who the board is. And that's what the show did a really good job of doing, was keeping you in the dark just enough, just like the employees, to where you want to find out what's going to happen, but also does a really good job of not paying you off from, you know, with cheap stuff. So I'll give this show, I mean, shit, man, 9.5 really Soviet era cars out of 10.
Nice, very fair. Gardner, what are your final thoughts and your rating of Severance Season 1?
Honestly, I don't know what I can say now that I haven't already said throughout this episode. I've been really effusive in my praise of this series. I really think everyone should at least give it a try. It's one of the most inventive and entertaining shows I've seen in a while. All that being said, I'm going to give it 9.6 egg parties out of 10. You gotta watch it.
Yeah, I love this show. I'm in for as long as they want to keep making it, I'll be watching. So I don't really have anything else to say other than it's a Duncan show. It's up my alley. I love it. I'm giving it 9.7 wellness checks out of 10. That wraps up the show. Thank you to our listeners for making it this far. Thank you to our returning listeners, as well as to our new listeners. We hope you enjoyed it, and we hope you will stick around as well. On top of those thank yous, we want to give a big thank you to Nyatva for joining us today. We loved having you on.
Absolutely. I'll be here soon.
Hell yeah. We usually say we hope to have you back on, but in your case, we know you're coming back in the future for a mini-series on the John Wick trilogy. So,
yes, sir.
That's a little tease for our listeners for an upcoming episode. Remember, we have our full episode releasing in 2 days on Friday, where we will be interviewing Alex Lorien. That was a great discussion, so check out his work down below. It is linked in the description. Remember, we also did Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse last Friday, and we just wrapped up our bonus miniseries on the Dark Knight trilogy, so check those out and get excited for future episodes as well. While you're waiting for our new episodes to drop, be sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram, at GoodDataPod. And on Facebook at GDT Podcast. And also subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or anywhere you listen to podcasts. Remember, you can always find us by searching the letters GDT anywhere podcasts are available. That's the end of the show. We will talk to you again on Friday.
Thank you for tuning in, folks. We love you. We'll see you on the next one.